coming in. And good evening, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight. This is Saturday night. It is July 15th, and we have a very special show for you tonight. 52 years ago, last night and tonight, we did something. The human race did something. The Americans did something. NASA did something that had never been done in modern American history before. Now, I use that qualifier because, as you're going to hear as we go through the evening, the human race is a lot older than we have been allowed to know. And everything we talk about in terms of history or historical context really only applies to, you know, from the time that, you know, modern science has kind of put together the sketchy outlines of our past, our origins, but does not seem to include an extraordinary span of time where the human race was on the planet doing astonishing things, and for reasons that are not quite clear, either ignorance or cover-up, we haven't been allowed to know all that. So every time I say something is historic, it's only historic in the context of the last 6,000 years, which is the proved, accredited Sumerian history. Someone has their mic open. They need to mute. So let me begin at the beginning. 52 years ago tonight, the Americans sent the Mariner 4 spacecraft, the first little spacecraft, unmanned robotic vehicle, on a flyby of Mars, the fabled planet Mars. It was a very primitive spacecraft by today's standards. It carried, among other things, a television system, a very crude black and white, and there were ways they could get some color out, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But basically, it was equipped to take on tape, on actual audio tape, not videotape, but audio tape, the camera and the signal processing instrumentation in the spacecraft, which was a big kind of paddle wheel shape affair. You can actually go to the other side of midnight.com, click on Radio with Pictures. That will take you to tonight's page. And if you kind of scroll down, you'll see an actual image of Mariner 4. For the time, it was kind of cool and beautiful and elegant. It even had an elliptical shaped antenna to beam the signal back to Earth along the plane of the Earth's orbit and not waste the energy above or below where the Earth would be in space. But by today's standards, it was incredibly primitive, and yet it was able to take 21 pictures, black and white pictures, and beam them back to Earth over the next several weeks. Because in those days, the radio transmitters in the spacecraft and the receivers on the ground were equally primitive, so on less than the light of a refrigerator bulb in your fridge, these pictures were beamed back, telemetered back, as the phrase goes, and it took the NASA scientists at JPL, the Mariner 4 team, something like 8.5 hours to reconstruct one picture. In fact, there's a very famous blackboard in the upper levels of the control center at JPL, where there is a big black and a big color montage of kind of like a poster, which the engineers use to manually take the numbers coming in the telemetry stream, and they assign those numbers that they could see visually coming off the teletype to various colors and shades of gray. And they literally hand put together a big mosaic on a wall of the first picture of Mars sent back 8.5 hours before from Mariner 4. And they beat the computer, because computers back in those days were big, clunky things. They took whole rooms. They, you know, were vacuum tubes. They required the cooling power of maybe, you know, Niagara Falls, or I'm kind of exaggerating there, but they were nothing compared to what you hold in your hand right now and call a smartphone. So with that primitive technology, 8.5 hours after the Mariner 4 spacecraft took the images, it sent enough data to Earth so that they were actually able to see on Earth from this engineer reconstruction, manual reconstruction, the first images from Mars, the first image, actually. So if you go to Radio with Pictures at theothersideofmidnight.com, scroll down, the first image, by the way, click on all these images. It makes a beautiful full screen view. You can zoom in and you can move around, you know, cursor up and down and all that. The first image is a kind of a poster montage of the mission, showing the footprint of where all the images were, showing the images off the edge of Mars, showing the little Mariner 4 in the upper right-hand corner. If you look at the second image down, that's the actual Mariner 4 spacecraft with the data block showing the date when it was launched. Not when it arrived, but that was when it was launched, November 28, 1964. The third image down is a closer view of Mars with the footprints of the various images arrayed across the Martian deserts, the way the camera was pointed when Mariner 4 flew by. Mariner 4 was not a close flyby. Mars is roughly 4,200 miles in diameter, and Mariner 4 was targeted, again, because of the primitive nature of the navigation, so that it would not impact the planet, because we didn't want to send Earth microbes to Mars and basically blow a whole ecosystem. So they targeted it so it would miss Mars by something like 6,000 miles. So these photographs, these 21, 22 photographs, were taken during the flyby with the spacecraft camera kind of looking out from under the skirt there. If you can look at the very bottom of that image number two, click on it, you'll see a little kind of protuberance. That's the camera on what was called a scan platform, meaning it could be rotated left and right and up and down. And depending upon where Mars was relative to Mariner 4, the computer had instructions sent laboriously days before from Earth where to point the camera so that Mars, that section of Mars, would be in the field of view when the camera arrived at that field of view, et cetera, et cetera. Basically the same they do now, except it was a lot hairier because the computer technology was oh so primitive. Oh my God. I mean, do you realize that if in your own smartphone you have more computer power than all of NASA, the entire NASA space agency had in 1964? And someone is calling, and I'm not quite sure who or oh my God, it's Dick Bertel. So I'll tell you what, I'm going to have to hang up on him, and I'm going to have to call him back on another line when we go to break. But we're going to have a little bit of a surprise here. So let me, Dick, please go away. Thank you, thank you. See, he has no idea what we're doing because he's on another line. Anyway, moving back down to the third image, those footprints, if you look very carefully, if you click on them and make them bigger, you'll see that in the overlap between the two sets of each image is like a pair. There's image one, image two, and they overlap in the bottom right corner of the first image and the top left corner of the second image, and so on through two and three and four and five and six, so that way all through the end of the sequence. In the middle where they overlap, if you look on the enlargement, if you click on image three and get the enlargement, you'll see that they are in color. And if you scroll down to image number four, there's a beautiful blow-up that was done with digital reconstruction 50-some years after this data came in. And it shows the overlap. It shows the fact that you've got two black and white images, and then you've got color in between. How the heck did they get color? Well, this is really kind of an interesting tale because that's how I got into the whole space game. At this time, in 1965, summer of 65, July 14th, 15th, that night, I was the curator of astronomy and space science at the Museum of Science in Springfield, Massachusetts. And when the specs came out before the November 28th launch, I picked up the phone in my esteemed position as curator. And I called NASA, I called JPL, I got some very nice people on the phone. One was named Frank Colella. He was head of public affairs. Another guy was named Frank Bristow, a name which will live in, well, maybe not infamy, but something close to it, because that's a whole other story. But Frank and I had a very interesting and tempestuous relationship until he resigned from NASA, retired actually. But I got these guys, and I got the Mr. Colella, and I explained that I was curator at this museum in Springfield, and we were setting up a project to cover the flyby live the night that Mariner 4 flew by Mars. And I was trying to run an experiment, which was to take these black and white pictures, which, had I mentioned before, were taken through color filters. They were taken through red and blue filters. And what you could do was you could overlap those corners, and by synthesizing green, in other words, averaging the brightness in the picture to make kind of a green, you could produce semi-full color. 1965. So here's this kid, 21, 22 years of age, at a museum in Springfield, calling NASA saying, hey, we're going to do this live that night, which in fact, pending the 8 1/2 hours, 8 1/3 hours for the image to come down, we tried to do, taking the images, which JPL actually express mailed across the country, so I could have in the next few days actual images to post as on display at the museum. And we tried our best to produce the color in those overlapping two frames. And I got to say, it didn't look anywhere near as good as what we're seeing here. So if you click on image four, you'll see what NASA, in their infinite wisdom, had decided to do some 50 plus years ago in terms of the first flyby of the planet Mars. Now, Mars, of course, is incredibly historic. This was groundbreaking. This was astonishing because, A, the effort, the outreach to actually pull this off, and B, they actually made it work. And that's what's really amazing. Now, we happen to have, and if our engineer is standing by, I will call on trusted Tom to put up the first clip we've got, which I think is the intro to the program that Dick Bertel, who just called in on the audio line, and I from WTIC in Hartford, Connecticut, they came up and they put up a full, what was called a radio remote at the museum. And we sat there at the museum in Springfield, Massachusetts, with a long-distance telephone line, high-quality bandwidth line to JPL, and we did an entire 5 1/2, 6 hours of programming live to the NBC affiliate WTIC and to, well, it was Clear Channel 50,000 watts, so it reached an awful lot of people. Potentially millions of people heard that broadcast that night because nobody else was doing this. NASA wasn't doing it. I mean, they did it in-house, but they weren't doing it on radio. The television networks, you know, had, you know, little inserts, but they didn't do 6 hours of continuous coverage. But we did. So, Tom, if you're standing by, run the first clip and let's hear what it sounded like to be there when history was made 52 years ago.
This is Dick Bertel at the Springfield Museum of Science in Springfield, Massachusetts. Tonight, WTIC presents complete coverage of Mariner 4 as it flies by the planet Mars on an historic photo-taking mission. In the next few hours, many questions may be answered. Tonight, after 8 months of patient waiting, is the night of the encounter. Tonight's program will be an historic first from many standpoints, not the least of which is the method of transmission. Portions of our program will actually be broadcast on a beam of light known as a laser beam, which will be operated by the PerkinElmer Corporation in Norwalk, Connecticut. An historic radio broadcast first. Here in the auditorium of the Springfield Museum are gathered almost 250 people, some of the top scientists in the country who will be sharing this microphone with me throughout the course of the evening. The general public is here, too, to learn firsthand what man has been speculating about for thousands of years. What is the mystery of the red planet Mars? We may know tonight. Closed-circuit television cameras are relaying pictures of what is happening here at the Mars complex to other buildings in the area where hundreds of others are gathered to watch these events. In the front of the auditorium is a huge screen on which will be flashed pictures and drawings that pertain to the planet. Here in Springfield, we'll be talking tonight to Dr. Sanford Siegel, noted exobiologist with Union Carbide in Tarrytown. Dr. Siegel has been conducting extensive experiments with life forms on a Martian atmosphere. Also here is Dr. Alan Hynek, noted astronomer and UFO investigator for the U.S. Air Force. We have a direct line to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and you'll be hearing exclusive WTIC reports, as well as general reports released by JPL to radio and television networks and to the press. With me now is Dick Hoagland, curator of astronomy and space science at the Springfield Museum of Science. And Dick, what has happened to this point?
Well, according to our information on a pre-programmed list released by JPL and also updated by current activity via our line, the spacecraft has been given about four commands. The first command to start the scan platform, to start the camera moving in an up and down plane to make sure that the motor is turning it so that it may aim toward Mars. The second command later on this afternoon, which stopped the platform at a preset angle so that as Mariner sweeps by the planet Mars at about 11,000 miles an hour, the camera will intercept the planet and begin taking those vital photographs. And just a few minutes ago, just before we went on the air, there was confirmation that the narrow or the wide angle sensor, a large telescopic device is looking at Mars now. For the first time in history, a spacecraft is looking down at the planet Mars, 134 million miles away, as Mariner 4 flies by.
The Mariner 4 spacecraft, which starts shooting pictures of Mars tonight, is just one step in a project that began 5 years ago and has cost about $125 million so far. The 21 or so pictures in this latest shot will cost about $6 million apiece. The ultimate goal of the Mariner project is to make a manned landing on Mars, but this probably won't come until around 1973, and before that step is taken, an attempt will be made to put an instrument package on the Red Planet to send back scientific data. With its space camera trained on Mars from a range of 9,438 miles, Mariner 4 is scheduled to begin taking the first of its pictures at 8:20 tonight in just about 10 minutes. The last of the pictures will be taken at about 8:45 to 8:50, and at that time, the camera, wearing a 30-power telescope to see better, will be only 6,770 miles from the surface of the planet. The spacecraft itself will make its closest approach to the Martian surface 18 to 20 minutes later. The Earth-sent device will be at that point only 5,412 miles from Mars, and then it will disappear behind Mars. At 7:41 tomorrow morning, our time, the Mariner 4 tape recorder turns on to send about 1 hour of scientific information to Earth across a void more than 134 million miles wide. After that information is cleared, the machine will begin relaying the first picture. Each one will take about 8 hours and 35 minutes to complete. And I assume, Dick, that we'll have those first pictures at about, oh, sometime Friday morning. At least the general public will have them.
Either Friday morning or Friday afternoon, and we're going to be talking more about those pictures later on, but let's wait until we know whether that tape is going to record any yet. You know,
Dick, let's talk right now about the laser beam, which it is hoped will broadcast a portion of this show a little later. First of all, we are not using the laser beam now, and for a very good reason. I wonder if you'd fill us in on the background of that.
It's foggy. The laser is a beam of light just like any other light. It can be stopped by the Earth's atmosphere. The fog is now rolled in across Springfield. We expect it to clear within about an hour or a little less. This beam of light is not like light in that it is coherent. It is like a radio wave or a set of radio waves traveling like soldiers, one behind the other, in perfect step.
Now, Dick, let's take a look at what we hope to discover tonight. In addition to the pictures, of course, which we're all very much concerned about, there are many other experiments which will be conducted tonight, not the least of which is the occultation experiment. What is the occultation experiment?
Well, scientists are very anxious to know more about the Mars atmosphere. As you know, Mars is a planet which has an atmosphere. This can be seen because we have photographed clouds and we have photographed the planet in various colored light, and it appears different sizes.
At this point, I think, Dick, we might call on Dr. Alan Hynek, the noted astronomer and UFO investigator for the U.S. Air Force, who is with us tonight. Dr. Hynek, if I may ask you, first of all, to move into the microphone so that we can hear you clearly. How do you feel about the experiments tonight? I saw a smile of pleasure cross your face, of course, when it was announced that the picture-taking sequence had indeed been started. What are your reactions tonight?
I'd like to be in communication with Kepler and Tycho Brahe.
I think
they would really, really enjoy this.
Dr. Hynek, I'm going to interrupt here for just a minute, and we are going to talk about the canals on Mars. News is happening in other parts of the world as well, and of course, we want to bring you up to date on that. So at this point, we're going to take 5 minutes out for NBC News on the Hour to return at 9:05 to the Springfield Museum of Science in Springfield, Massachusetts. This is WTIC 1080 on your dial in Hartford, Connecticut. 9:00.
Be alert to news as it happens on the NBC Radio Network.
Well, that is interesting. How does that make you feel, Dick? Okay. And welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight. My name is Dick Hoagland. There's another Dick on the line, Dick Bertel, who is the announcer and the chief impresario of our amazing event, 52 years. 52 years, Dick, have we known each other half a century?
More than that, Dick. More than that. Probably. We've been working together for 55 years, and I was just thinking, it's nice to get together with you every 50 years or so to do another show.
Well, you know, when we reach the 100-year thing, we're going to have to do this again, right?
Right.
Give people a little background how this special at WTIC. First of all, give people a thumbnail sketch of what WTIC was, because nowadays when we talk about radio affiliates, it's like computers and rooms full of tape or carts, or now it's all digital, you know, it's not, you can't even see it. But back then, WTIC was like a mini version in New England, Hartford, Connecticut, of NBC in New York itself. It was
absolutely.
It was like, and everybody was forced to wear shirts and ties and suits, even the engineers.
That's exactly right, and even on weekends, that was the standard practice in most large 50,000-watt radio stations. So we weren't that unusual, but it was the custom. And they wanted to continue with good, imaginative radio long after television came on the scene. They owned their own Channel 3, as you know, but that wasn't enough. They were going to continue with radio, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Now, WTIC stood for the
Travelers Insurance Company.
Yeah. So they were kind of like a major corporation owning a radio and television outlet, so they could kind of do what they wanted to do for a long time.
Absolutely. And profit, at least in the early days, was not a motive. So they wanted the image. They wanted the Travelers' image to be heard throughout New England. So that's what they did. And so now this program, yeah, go ahead, Dick.
Well, I was going to say, how come this program got such incredible attention? And tell people, A, how you helped me convince them to do it, and then B, what they agreed to do versus what we wound up actually doing.
You know, we're reaching back so far. I did a sales pitch on them. I said, you know, I said, this young guy up in Springfield, Massachusetts, can put this program together on the flyby of Mariner 4 to Mars. And I said, it will be spectacular. And I told them of the many guests you had lined up. I told them of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and that connection. And so they said, well, do it for an hour. We'll let you run the show from 8 to 9.
Oh, my. Prime
and
time.
That's the way we went on the air. Now, about 9:15, as we were on the air, I got the word, stay on the air as long as it takes.
Wow. So we convinced somebody. Now, do you remember who the program director was at TIC?
I'm trying to think. I think Ross Miller may have been the program director
Time.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something I've never told anybody, certainly not a global audience. After I left that meeting where we both together pitched this and they agreed to do it, I had to drive to Boston for some reason. And I'm driving up, you know, that little cutoff that takes you up to the Mass Turnpike and then you get into Boston from Hartford and all that.
Yep.
As I'm driving along, I happened to look down and I realized that I had worn two different styles of socks, colors of socks, in this critical meeting. And Ross Miller still said yes. So you and I must have been incredibly persuasive for them to give us an hour. A whole hour.
1 hour. But you see, by this time, they realized that Perkin-Elmer was going to attempt to broadcast at least portions of the show on a laser beam, which would have been a first for any radio station.
Yeah, tell people what that was all about.
Well, I'm not quite sure because I was pretty much involved in the program. But the idea was that Perkin-Elmer would transmit from Springfield to a point, I guess, probably on Avon Mountain outside of Hartford, the program signal on a laser beam. And then, of course, it would be rebroadcast through the master control in Hartford and on the air. And it was a first. It would be an absolute first. Not much of the broadcast was actually on the laser beam. It was staticky. I think there was a problem with fog that night.
Well, the first problem we had, because I had been involved in the installation, and I was the guy that went to Perkin-Elmer and said, you know, you got to do this for history and all this.
Sure,
The idea was to aim a laser, which was brand new back in 1965. No one had heard of them. My grandfather worked for the government. He worked at Fort Detrick. And I remember naively once mentioning in that time period to him lasers, and I'd never seen my grandfather get really angry. Somehow he thought I had tripped over some kind of top secret classified information, and that he, because I, you know, I had free run of their house, that he, that I'd maybe gone in a room or a drawer or something and opened it and read something that I wasn't supposed to. Because this was long before this show, because lasers were so, they were so Buck Rogers. They were so incredible.
Oh, they were, absolutely, yeah.
So I had gone down to Perkin-Elmer and I said, well, we're going to do this big thing, you know, Mars and Mariner and all these guests. And they sent a whole team. They must have spent like $50,000 to send people.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised, yes. And WTIC was the recipient of all of this, the recipient of their engineering, the recipient of your guests, the ones you had lined up, because you did it. All we did was produce a program around it.
And how do we have, we're going to go by the 30 break. When we get out of this, Tom, we'll just get out of this, okay? Because this is too interesting. Because people now have no idea the kind of bootstraps you had to do in the background to pull these things off. And that one that night actually worked. Because the laser, when we focused it from the rooftop of the museum over to, it was Proven Mountain, not the Avon. And then it came back. It was like redirected back to the museum. And then fed into the to the show, and then down to the control center and all that. So it was basically a two-way link out and back to Proven Mountain. And the reason it was so staticky in the early hours of the evening, because we started what, like 8 o'clock, something like that.
Yes, 8 o'clock.
Because and you know, July 15th on the East Coast, the sun sets around 8:30, quarter nine. So you had incredible thermal problems. You had all that burbling of heat rising up from the landscape 10 miles over to Proven Mountain and 10 miles back. So you could hear, audio-wise, how terrible lasers would be if you tried to beam them through the atmosphere looking forward from 1965. At the end of the evening, 6 hours later, when it was like the middle of the night, it was like, what, midnight, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, something like that?
Well, probably 11 o'clock or so, but when we got the good signal.
We got a wonderful signal, and if you listen to the actual half hour that you were able to save, tell people how we actually have a recording of this amazing historical event. No thanks to anybody at WTIC, but thanks to Dick Bertel.
I just thought it was so important, Dick. I thought it was historic. I was right. And I decided that I would do a capsule version of the program. I didn't think to keep the 4 hours, but I gave a summation on tape, and that's what we have today.
Absolutely amazing. Amazing. I'll tell you what, to take us out, why don't we play the second clip, Tom, and then we'll go to break, and then we'll come back and we'll get to the rest of my guests. Dick Bertel, I want to thank you so much for interrupting your busy schedule. You must have been out for the evening and just got back and seen my message, and you called. My God, you called.
Exactly right, yes. Exactly right.
Well, let's do this again another 50. No, I'm. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr.
Dick, it's always great working with you.
Okay. Thank you. Hit it, Tom.
WTIC in Hartford, Connecticut.
This is Dick Bertel back at Mars Complex at the Springfield Museum of Science in Springfield, Massachusetts. We had information from NBC that the tape recorder had not turned off, as you heard just a few moments ago, and this is contrary to information that we have here. So just to confirm it, we have a situation where everything is green, all systems are acting and working properly. We're going to call in Dick Lewis on our special jet propulsion laboratory line in Pasadena, California. Dick, have you heard anything to the contrary? Is everything working as it should?
There is a fear among the people who have been examining the telemetry that the tape recording device may not have shut off after each picture as it was supposed to do. If this was the case, then the total number of pictures taken by the camera and recorded, or the total number of pictures recorded on the tape, would be reduced from the maximum of 21 to a maximum of 7 or 8.
However, there is a considerable amount of optimism that all of the pictures have been recorded and will be played back in the ensuing day.
Dick, I just want to mention that your voice is once again being carried by laser beam here in Springfield, Massachusetts. This is an historic broadcast first. I want to clarify something with you. As I understand it, the tape recorder is designed to stop when the shutter of the camera is closed and then to start up again when the shutter opens. Is that true?
That's right.
All right, so that if the tape recorder did continue and did not stop, there would be long periods of blank spaces, so to speak, on the tape. Is that it?
That's right. It would be analogous to a motion picture camera running when the shutter is, when the lens cap is on, the operator forgetting to shut it off. It would simply mean that not as many, it would come to the end of the roll before all of the pictures had been taken.
All right, Dick Lewis, we're going to terminate our conversation at this point, but I hope you will stand by so that we can call you in again in a few minutes. Thank you, Dick Lewis.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt at this point. We have Fred Stone on our special telephone line now. Fred Stone is with Raymond Engineering Laboratories in Middletown. Fred, I'm sure you've been listening to reports of the Mariner 4's progress, and do you have any theories that you might advance as to the question regarding the possibility that the tape recorder did not shut off between pictures?
Well, as it was mentioned, this is, at this point, just a possibility. The situation hasn't really been proved. But as far as the operation of the tape recorder is concerned, it is under control of the data automation system.
Frank, can you stand by for just a moment, please? We have a direct report from Mariner Control, and then we'll be back.
This is Mariner Control. At the present time, the data from the television period, photographic period, is still being reviewed. There is as yet no resolution of the apparent anomaly between the data information which was sent during the process and the data information which was sent on the basis of stored data after we returned to the mode 2 data transmission.
Fred, I don't know if you were able to hear that report, but the situation is still indeterminate as far as the tape recorder is concerned. Now, I wonder if you'd continue.
Well, Dick, as I started to say, the tape recorder is under control of the data automation system. It receives a start command at the beginning of each picture and a stop command at the end of each picture. These are commands which come to the tape recorder from a system external to it. In a tape recorder, there is one device, a relay, which actually stops and starts the motor. So we have, from our standpoint, two possibilities, an external problem or a problem with this particular relay.
I'm going to interrupt you again, Fred, for another report from Mariner Control.
6:30 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. The Mariner has passed its closest approach to Mars and is now slowly moving away from it. The distance to the surface of Mars from the Mariner is at this time 7,163 miles. Repeat, distance from Mariner to the surface, 7,163 miles.
A reminder, you're listening to the Night of Encounter.